Welcome, Julian.
Thanks a lot.
Julian is from New Zealand, currently living in Berlin, and he started out as a new media artist, and graduated, so to say, as a full-blown engineer to his work. And he's doing art that shows the complexity of the world and in a way that only someone who can actually understand the complexity of the world or is fully involved in these complexities can show. And you will show us today stuff like the Transparency Grenade or Newsweek, yep. Which I actually saw myself at Ars Electronica in 2011. Cool. And even though I didn't know you then, I became a fan.
Oh, cool.
So I'm looking very much forward to that.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Thanks all. Okay, so it's been a long day for everyone, of course, and particularly me. I'm not going to say I've had the longest day, but I've had at least the second to longest day. Had about 2.5 hours sleep coming in from Paris, and just seen some amazing lectures, particularly one on supersymmetry, which I actually had to leave in order to actually stop my brain turning into a kind of fruit salad, so that I could give this talk, but I wanted to continue into the fruit salad status and had to retract. Amazing. Well, anyway, I'm going to be talking about mostly critical engineering. I'm going to give some sort of background to the movement, if you like. I mean, it has certainly taken off in the last couple of years. And I'm going to use about a third of the lecture covering that substrate, that basis, and then I'm going to go and show you a whole bunch of projects that I think represent critical engineering, both as a sort of a as an ethos, if you like, but as a technopolitical practice, and very much as an engineering practice of its own. So, art of the exploit. What do I mean by this? Well, first of all, I'll just start talking about the art part. There was a really nice piece of neon artwork or neon signage on the outside of the Altes Museum in Berlin for quite some years, and it said all art has been contemporary. And I think that's a very important thing to remember when we are looking at the relevance of a given artistic or critical practice in relation to the now. You can, in fact, go right back through human history and find work that now, of course, would look traditionally old or, you know, antiquated, but at the time was the most rigorous expression available to artists at that time without having their heads cut off. One very, very famous work was by Bruegel the Elder, and this was painted in 1559. This was was for many years, and in fact still is now really, the closest depiction of what medieval life was like, well, life at least in the 1500s. It depicts a non-idealized representation of reality in those times. Naturally, drunkenness was the predominant activity, it looks like, in that time. But also, you know, people engaging in the marketplace, in the chaos of the marketplace, playing with chickens, admittedly like soccer balls, but yeah, it's just a general madness of that time, and also a sense of revelry, a sense of decay, of suffering is all represented in that singular image. And I found this very fascinating in that the singularity, if you like, of that image. Containing what anthropologists agree is a very, very stark and coherent representation of life in that time, it would be extremely difficult to do today. I mean, for instance, we are just to focus on a couple of people walking inside this scene. We see this this character here. The one's got some sort of odd growth on his back of some sort. I don't know whether he's sort of smuggling a small child or something like that, but this is a guy with a lantern, and walking arm in arm down the street, and they're having an intimate conversation. What would be the equivalent of that today in a European city? Maybe even in Ghent or Antwerp or somewhere in Netherlands or Belgium. that kind of intimacy could be a guy on a brick phone like this talking to his mate. The actual movement of people itself would need to be coordinated by a system of signaling and an infrastructure of signaling, if you like. In this case, we have the classic red light, green light. You know, walk, don't walk. The monetary aspect itself. You know, where people actually get cash. You know, maybe rather than trading a goat for a bag of rice, or some other form of property at that time. The cash itself can actually be pulled literally out of the wall, and that itself represents also an inability for us to coherently and singularly represent the flow of forces, if you like, the network of forces that comprises what we understand to be contemporary European life today. Then, of course, behind that that ATM machine, behind that Geldautomat, we have trading, we have the broader financial marketplace. Of course, now we understand that that's heavily impacted by high-frequency trading, which itself is built atop a bedrock, a substrate of algorithmic inputs and modifiers, parametric and disruptive in other ways. Even the food itself. I mean, if we were to represent that marketplace scene of people purchasing food from someone that's sitting on a barrel. In order to do that now, we would have to talk about these weird things, these indoor representations of that market with these repeating products sitting in boxes with expiry dates, which of course, for much of our food system, depends heavily on this thing called refrigeration. The Center for Disease Control in the United States has covered extensively the impact on human life and in contemporary human life of refrigeration just ceasing to exist. Huge numbers of us would be dead in a couple of weeks due to food poisoning. But of course, we know the fridge is something like this. So we're heavily dependent upon all sorts of forces and networks of forces as inputs in order to maintain, if you like, even support this thing that we call everyday urban life. Now, what we deal with now, as opposed to back in the time of Bruegel the Elder, is this increasing problem of this diametric of invisibility and visibility. We have this running problem of the inability to see the inner workings of our technologically engineered and mediated environment. Bruno Latour, a very, very smart man, said, when a machine runs efficiently, when a matter of fact is settled, one need focus only on its inputs and outputs and not on its internal complexity. Thus, paradoxically, the more science and technology succeed, the more opaque and obscure they become. So the better running of a system, of a machine, the more it actually increases to become, or tends to become closed and become opaque. Bruno was very polemic at the time for introducing, among many things, actor network theory, et cetera, but also this idea of the black box. He really brought it into a lot of critical rhetoric at the time, looking at the problem of opacity as regards systems. And here we have an interesting representation of a black box. We have the input coming in on the left and output over here, but in the middle we have a hidden feedback control loop. And that, for me, is a very, very interesting starting point for looking at some of the techno-political challenges of our time today. And of course, things become increasingly problematic when we start talking about this thing called infrastructure. When we look at the internet, or representations of the internet, as of course a network of networks that wasn't ever so much designed as just sort of emerged. As an ongoing attempt for networks to connect to other networks. You know, this tree of stars phenomenon we have with IPv4 and the sort of clustering around NAT. But to an end user, I like a quote I heard earlier that the only people that refer to users are software designers and drug dealers. When we are talking about users, you know, we're pushed into this field of surfaces. In themselves, much of the time, thankfully, Mozilla Firefox is not playing that game of opacity, but we are pushed into this kind of a black box. Again, a kind of skinning over, at least as regards the World Wide Web, not the internet itself, but the web, which provides, of course, many conveniences, but comes with the cost of a lack of visibility or transparency. Now, engineered infrastructure is a part of our environment. I mean, I grew up in New Zealand where I couldn't see another house, surrounded by beautiful indigenous forests that had never been cut down. That's where I grew up. And now I live in cities, and I'm regularly aware still to this day, having spent 10 years living here in Europe, of just the presence of infrastructure. And it always makes me nervous, it always has. But the idea that we can actually have an environment, an urban environment, and talk about it as a singular thing, is problematic, not just for reasons of wanting to be able to depict contemporary life, but in order to be able to understand how that environment shapes us. On a small scale, we can look at an object like this. This is obviously the gramophone, which was the shit-hot MP3 player of its time. And I like to think of this actual object as very much a social object, very much an extroverted object in its own sense. If you look at it, all of its inner functionality is expressed outwardly. We see the horn where the sound comes out, and if the record is actually playing, we can put our ear to that horn, and we can confirm with our ear that is in fact where the sound is very much being amplified and pushed out into the room, structured air pressure effectively. But if we actually look at the crank, we can see this as our energy input, and we can wind that crank, and in doing so, we see an immediate response with the platter itself actually spinning. And if we look close enough on the record itself, we can see a little needle bobbing up and down as it winds around the spiral of that record. So the inner workings of this object are expressed outwardly. It's a highly porous, transparent, or should say at least translucent object in that regard. Compare it to the iPod Nano, which just represents or is represented by a field of surfaces. It presents itself as a skinned object of metaphors, you know, fast forward and rewind. My girlfriend Christelle told me how she was trying to explain to a young boy the phenomenon, the experience of rewind and fast forward from her experience growing up with tapes, with cassettes, and he just could not fathom the concept. You know, had to actually pull out a cassette, put it into a machine, and show him what it was to fast forward and rewind. Naturally, now we skip. So already we start to see these sort of metaphors themselves playing into the way that we use technology and also informing back into the design. But if you take this field of surfaces and you're really interested in understanding how it works and what it does, you have to open it up. And almost no one you or I know could tell you precisely exactly how an iPod Nano works. They wouldn't be able to. Most people wouldn't be able to tell you where the DSP chip is. They wouldn't tell you where the digital signal processor is on this board. They might not even recognize the power interface to the battery. They might not even recognize the lithium battery itself as being a power source. So the opacity is also expressed sort of inwardly in this problem of ever retreating scale. Most of us, at least, I mean, maybe not here at the C3, but most of us can say that we don't really know the devices in our pockets. You know, these things that we sleep right next to and walk around with and speak into. Here, for instance, is the wireless radio part of an iPhone 4. So the right to deconstruct, modify, and ruin are rights that actually come with ownership, or at least should. This is something that's very, very important to me personally. The right to open those things that we own, even just to study them, is increasingly contested. Now there's a wall of lawyers between us and an object that we have in our pockets. You know, to open that object, to actually open it up and inspect it and study it, is already treading on legal territories. This is why we should stop talking about. We should start talking about lawyers in a new plural. I would like to start referring to a murder of lawyers. Like you got a murder of crows, you know, those beautiful black birds, but a murder of lawyers. I think that's better. What we need is the right to read, write, and execute, as regards the objects that we own. And this is something that needs to be not just pushed in the form of policy reform and that kind of thing. It needs to be actively upheld through the daily practice of studying that which we hold near to us, that infrastructure, and that which we depend upon most personally, most importantly. What's at stake? Of course, we have the yes, we scan problem, that charismatic man. This is my album, by the way. Just made it. But yeah, we have this. I mean, incredible stuff. Like, for instance, you know, this one I read on CNET a while ago. Senate bill rewrite lets feds read your email without warrants. If you were to ask, but this gets down to the problem of education, the problem very much of language. If you were to ask just about anyone you know how the postcard that you sent them arrived in their mailbox, they would be able to give you a relatively coherent description of the process or the set of processes that resulted in that postcard arriving in a mailbox. They would talk about the van, the postleitzahl island postcodes, you know, the fact that there is this combination of street numbers and names, we call addresses, you know. But they, if you were to ask that same person how the email that you sent them arrived in their inbox, very few people you know would be able to do so without leaning on and relying on high surrealism and extremely imaginatively rich poetry in order to, and they still wouldn't even get close. And this is precisely why this kind of thing can happen. Again, if you were to tell people that, speaking of data retention and the like, if you were to tell people that all of the letters, the physical, you know, snail mail letters that they've been sending for years using the postal system, have been taken into a special room that no one can see inside. They've been steam opened carefully. The letters have been taken out. They've been copied. And then the sender and recipient of that envelope has been copied and will put into a database. There'll probably be a lot of old people in the streets burning cars in protest. But instead, we have this thing called data retention. So we have, again, another layer of opacity there where language and the technical complexity, the abstraction, is coming between us and having a meaningful conversation about the techno-political challenges of the world that we live in. And this is where assholes like this have a free hand. They can just come in, play poker with a flip of a sneaky dime, you know, one-sided coin, and then yeah, we're all sleeping next to the NSA as they stroke our hair while we sleep. Engineering is complex; its terms are abstract. That's that other layer of opacity I was just referring to then. For instance, what is a computer network? What is the internet? Very few people can answer that question with any degree of realism. This is my definition of the internet based on my questions going out to people and the feedback I've got back. It's a deeply misunderstood technology. The smart ass at the party whose brother is a brain surgeon will say it's a series of tubes, of course. Other people will just refer to it as a magical, powerful reality. Of course, the Matrix is their first point of call. You know, they just reach for that. That's the first thing. Because the internet is somehow everywhere now. You know, it's in the air itself. It's a subatomic particle, the internet, I think. Or it's this highly centrist model, you know, a throbbing, you know, sort of dark star, in this case a purple dark star, of sentience and awareness. And you get humanities guys at the future of the internet and the internet belongs to the people kind of debates, talking about the internet as an entity, as a living thing, and also talking about, you know, the internet as something that truly belongs to the people. And again, their lack of awareness as to the real infrastructural reality of the internet doesn't afford them the insight that they need in order to inform those claims. The internet is, in fact, as many of us here know, a highly privatized space, right from the physical layer right up to even the application layer. Where am I on the internet? Few people can say, you know, you're here. You know, very few people can actually do that. I mean, you know, GeoIP. In fact, where people's data is, of course, in these things called data centers. I mean, as I've said in a few talks this last year, your drunken tweets and Facebook wall are buried underground, surrounded by dirt, machine guns, lawyers, and tax. I mean, that's where it is, actually. You know, you would find it very, very difficult to have the right of access to see that hard disk containing that file system that has that drunken tweet on it that you wished you never sent. Instead, we pushed this children's book representation of the technical reality, the cloud, a very dangerous reduction, almost an absolute pathetic, patronizing reduction of that thing that we call the internet, the cloud. I mean, there was a big survey done in the US. I wish I could cite it directly right now. Since many of you remember, it was quite famous. It was a large proportion of Americans believed that cloud computing was affected by bad weather. Now there is a little something in it. I mean, if there is a you know typhoon and you've got your power grid knocked out, then yeah, the cloud's down. But I don't think they were reaching quite that far, those guys. So we need to see the land through the clouds. This, for instance, is on Apple's data centers. This is where a lot of people's iTunes profiles are stored. And as I've also said in a couple of talks, it clearly doesn't have the je ne sais quoi of an Apple product. I mean, it just doesn't, you know. And the way that the trees are lined up there, and if you look really closely, there's really, really high, heavy-duty fences there. There's definitely four or five guys walking around there with submachine guns. You know, I mean, there's probably two layers of passport checks. You know, so when we talk about ownership and the internet and our political relationship with this thing called the internet, we need to get down to the metal. Instead, we're pushed this again field of surfaces, the iPod Nano effect. I refer to this as an ideology of seamlessness, this expectation that things should always be seamless. In fact, I like to get back, at least in my practice and those of my colleagues, this thing called seamfulness, of bringing the edges into the picture. What's the time now, actually? How much have I got? Half an hour? Cool, great. So the submarine cable map is for me, an excellent example of the kinds of initiatives that, admittedly, it was intended for the investor market, for people to invest in this thing called submarine cables, but it's had a really interesting spin-off effect in the critical community talking about the problems of talking about the internet as a thing that belongs to the people. When you look at the submarine cable map on submarinecablemap.com, you can click on the cables that connect countries and in fact envelop and wrap around countries and see the owners. You find very, very quickly that when you're clicking on these submarine cables that very few of them even have public ownership of any sort, even as a share. There's hardly any government ownership of these cables, entirely privatized. And now, as we've seen with the GCHQ and the NSA and, of course, black boxing and tapping these submarine cables, that right of access is effectively a financial transaction. There isn't the public ownership in order to represent the rights that we expect on this thing called the internet at even the physical layer. So critical engineering is really getting away from this definition of engineering as the practical application of science to commerce or industry and really looking at how we can forget about the utility and forget about industry an application industry, forget about the economics of it all, and just actually look at how can we use this thing, this collection of languages and concepts around engineering, and the many different disciplines of engineering, how can we use them critically in order to open up public dialogue about this infrastructure that we depend upon. So critical engineering is a frame for applied research and development that positions engineering rather than art or design as primary within the creative and critical process. So it's about turning engineering from being a discipline known to the these cliches are really boring, but the sandal wearing Brians of the world or something like this, and actually saying that it's now's the time that we all need to develop a basic vocabularic interface to this thing called engineering, such that we can meaningfully describe and therefore critically engage the world that we live in. Critical Engineering Manifesto was written in 2011 by this guy, and myself. And it was quickly translated into 14 languages, and it can now be found in labs all around the world. It's so-called hack labs, makerspaces and things. It's made its way into university programs. It's now part of curricula, even recently at the MIT, thanks to Golden Levin. And it turns out that we did hit a bit of a nerve, positively. Critical engineering seeks to answer questions surrounding influence and control in a world of integrated systems and closed, opaque technology. And the first point in the manifesto is this: critical engineer considers engineering to be the most transformative language of our time, shaping the way we move, communicate, and think. It's thus the work of the critical engineer to study and exploit this language, exposing its influence. The first work I want to talk about as regards representing this thing called critical engineering is my favorite work from 2012. It's by Gordon Savicic, one of the co-authors of the manifesto. You saw his face before. And Bengt Sjolin, very talented Swede, who is my studio partner in Berlin. And Packet Broker was developed for a big exhibition that we did in the Haus der Kultur in der Welt in Berlin that opened on the day of Transmediala. We were given a nice big room and we were asked to come up with 10 works for the exhibition. And the one that Gordon and Bengt came up with was very special indeed. What they did was in the studio... Well, who here is familiar with MAC addresses, link layer? Yeah, beacon frames. I'll just do a quick. So here we have a whole bunch of different stations around us right now. Obviously, we have these MAC addresses here. We have that represent our access points, BSSIDs. We have probe requests over here. And we have these things called beacons. And these beacons are really at the management layer of wireless networks. It's another representation of this. I mean, there's a huge number of these beacons flying around the room right now, and these are vital for the inner functioning of wireless networks at the link layer. Now, as far as Packet Broker is concerned, they were really interested in the fact that there are these location services, what we call fine-grained location services versus coarse-grained, like GPS, that many of us are highly dependent upon on our so-called smartphones or spying devices you can make calls on, as Jacob said a while ago. What they wanted to do was to show it was perfectly possible to intervene on that geolocation dependency. For instance, obviously, we all knew about the Carrier IQ scandal, where people were inadvertently on their smartphones capturing beacons that were then being pushed back to the mothership and then being used to build comprehensive location, fine-grained location maps, if you like, built around access points all around the world. And now when someone is dissatisfied with GPS, they can, of course, switch to this fine-grained location services. They set up a tree of 802.11 radios in the studio, which is in Neukölln in Berlin, and then down at the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, which is right on the other side of town, they had the equivalent sister tree of these 802.11 radios. Now, each one of these represents a different chunk of the 802.11 spectra. So we have a channel represented by each one of these antennae, you can say. They captured beacon frames at the studio, and then sent them over a tunnel to the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, where they were launched back into the air. And we had 2,000 people come through the door of our exhibition in the Haus der Kultur in der Welt. 2,000 people came in just into our room alone. And huge numbers of them were walking out into the night around the Haus der Kultur in der Welt with their phones glowing up on their faces, looking for hotels, bars, and restaurants that didn't exist around the Haus der Kultur in der Welt. They existed in Neukölln around the studio. So they had entirely folded the map. People were genuinely confused. You know, there's just They'd say, I swear it was here. You could see people walking out into this weird little forest out opposite the, you know, just really, you know, friends loyally following. It's just a... And this is for me really important because it uses the it leverages this implicit trust that we place on technology, uses it as a vulnerable surface, intervenes on that, and then throws the whole infrastructure back in your face and says, look, you know, you are depending on something that itself puts you in a highly volatile and vulnerable position. It's all about that belief. And Null Sticker, a really neat piece made very recently by Dennis Paul. He's probably here. He's probably the one clapping just then. Was that you, Dennis? Don't clap at your own stuff, man. It's just something you don't do. Joking. It's a really neat piece. This, it doesn't need to be complex, you know, a work of critical engineering. Here's a good example. Null Sticker. You get it. It's cool. It's just really great. Yeah. So of course, you know, you plug that into the wall, and a fuse blows, and you take out the effectively a large scale version is would do this, but you know, you can wear it as a necklace. I really like it as for a poetic inversion. You know, you take the, just fold that back in, create a loop, and then poof, blown, super. There's a piece made by me this year with a lot of help from my girlfriend building the tank. It's called No Network. No Network is a GSM jammer in the form of a battle tank. It's just a little object that you know, just it plays with cyber warfare and this whole, you know, kind of metaphor of cyber war. But when you flip the switch, it knocks you off the network with a sphere of around about 6 meter radius around the actual object, so people can experience in a controlled environment, you know, ideally, you know, being off the grid, if you like, you know, in that regard. And this is something that is increasingly rare. I mean, I love going back to my home country of New Zealand and just simply being at the family farm and not being able to receive calls, make them, or you know, SMSs. I'm really uncontactable because there just simply is no network there. There are no cell towers. What's that? That's the next one. I really want to do that, actually. Make it remote control. Just send it off down the street. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just be a really bad neighbor. Yeah, fail my German immigration. Yeah. Yeah. And you can just see the little jammer inside there. Transparency Grenade is a project that I made for the exhibition in the House of Kultur und Welt that again looks at this metaphor of cyber warfare and the cyber weapon and tries to create a kind of an iconic handheld, fully functional package that deals with some of these questions we have around opacity and data and transparency, particularly in the government and corporate sector, where we're fully aware that these very powerful entities are making decisions increasingly behind closed doors. And I wanted to come up with a handheld iconic solution to that, and came up with this. It's based on the Soviet F1 hand grenade, and it's just around about the same size. It's got all lovely silver work made by a very talented metal worker, Suzanne Stauch, who also lives in Berlin. It's got a little microphone, quite a powerful microphone. It's a Gumsticks Overo Com, a little tiny ARM-based board on the inside, and I'm running Debian on it, my operating system of choice, wherever possible. And it has a little LED bar graph there. And when you pull the pin on this, it captures all of the wireless traffic it possibly can in its proximity, and then tunnels it up to my server, where a Perl script goes through and then pulls out HTML, JPEG, GIF, PNG fragments, and then does the TCP stream following, and then shows in real time on a map what people are doing. So someone can, for instance, be, you know. Someone could be checking their email or something like this, and obviously when I've shown this in public, I've shown it at the Nemo Museum in Amsterdam, very, you know, huge museum in downtown Amsterdam, and many other big places. I showed it right next to the Pentagon, actually, at the Corcoran Gallery there, and people have to be warned, you know, when you're entering the room, you know, be aware that you're, you know, that you need to have your have your shit locked down. You have to be secured. And that itself, that the terror of the object, and representing itself as a violent weapon, gets people talking. And so you see mother and daughter and grandpa having a chat about the phone and the grenade. You know, just trying to work things out. You know, just trying to reduce that sharing. That unintended emission. Prism, the beacon frame, is just a little project that Dunya Vasiliev and I, again co-author of the manifesto, put together in 2 days for Art Hack Day in Berlin. This is a very little project that is intended to, it's a speculative proposal of what NSA. Wireless network forensics equipment might look like, but also obviously with the joke of having a big prism in the middle of it. And when this thing runs, I'll show you a video in a second. The prism spins when someone is merely in the room, and there's a network that they are associating with. And when they ask for a DHCP lease, you know, they ask for a lease on that network, ask for an IP. That boot P packet that goes out, we capture it and we show inside the prism the host name of the device. And if it's an iPhone, it's almost always Sarah's iPhone, Tom's iPhone, you know, Tim's iPhone. And then underneath it, the MAC address. This looks like this. Hopefully we've got some audio. Prism it is, yeah. Susie Woe's iPhone, yeah. And look, what's that? It's Angela Merkel's iPhone. Incredible. Oh, it's BlackBerry. What the hell is she doing there? It's weird. Anyway. So yeah, and this is just it's just one of the wonderful things about working in a free software environment from a creative perspective is you can just cobble stuff together. I mean, what Bengt, Dunya, Gordo, and I do all the time is we just glue everything together with shell scripts. You know, it's fantastic. You know, there's FIFOs and piping and Unix pipes, and you can really rapidly prototype in this context. I would never ever dream of working outside of this domain. You can really get good work done fast. It's a 2-day project. At Transmediale, this next one, 2014, we're going to have a really sinister version of that project. If you want to come and see it. Martin Hauser is a very important developer, artist, engineer in this scene. He made a work that I think is very, very important. The Earth Boot computer. He's really interested in the fact that our hardware is sort of detached, at least conceptually, in our mind, from the earth in which those minerals are in fact found. You know, much of what we actually have in our pockets comes from a vast diverse array of geographical locations, and there's a huge number of different hands and minds and processes involved in producing that thing that we call, for instance, a motherboard or something like that. He made a computer, in the form of an Earth boot computer, that this machine only boots if you actually stick it in the ground. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful project. You stick it in the ground, and it actually uses the very fine electricity running through the soil of the Earth itself as a literally a programming interface. It programs directly the computer and affects directly its runtime function. let's stick it in the ground. And here's one here just sort of stuck in the ground over here. I mean, this is a very, very poetic, you know, philosophical representation of, I think, another way of approaching critical engineering. You know, imagine if, for instance, the phone in your pocket needed contact with the ground from where it actually came, arguably, in order to function. I'm not going to talk about border bumping because I'm out of time, I think. I've been doing a lot of work in cell tower research, and I'm very focused on cellular network infrastructure at the moment. But just very, very briefly, regarding infrastructure and hidden infrastructure, opacity takes other forms. You know, this removal from view of the engineered reality of the world that we live in, particularly in the form of these things called stealth cell towers. There's a bizarre design practice of disguising cell towers as other things, like and they're almost always bad. I mean, this one here is a cell tower badly disguised as a tree in a place called Bronham in England. It's an archive put together by Chris Pynchon, who went through countless examples of stealth cell towers that people have found and ones that I myself have found, and put it into some PDFs for my research. And what we see here is a growing community of radio enthusiasts that are going around and finding these things. Here's one disguised as a street lamp, and it was only found, I was told, it was only found because people in this absolutely horrible, gloomy part of England were trying to walk home to their houses, obviously in the world's worst weather, and there was a street lamp that never functioned ever. And I mean, all they had to do was to apply power to put a bulb in it and apply power, and no one would have investigated what this thing was and found out that it's actually a cell tower. This is the best one of all. I mean, some really poor sod had the job of trying to disguise cell towers as bricks, and so they obviously went up there on a ladder and took a photograph of those bricks. And then, you know, loyally went down to the print shop, I suppose, and printed out some vinyl onto adhesive vinyl, but didn't use UV-resistant adhesive vinyl. So as time goes on, the disguise effect, shall we say, is sort of, you know, there's an attrition there, it wears off, and they become more and more visible. Anyway, this is an example of the corporate level, in the physical infrastructure world, individuals actively working to ensure that cell, you know, that you are not aware that there's a cell tower going up next to your kindergarten, you know, that your kid goes to, or something like this, because people don't like that idea. I'm going to talk about finally trust in engineering. Going to conclude here with a project called NewsTweak that was made by Daniel Vasiliev, Dania, and myself in 2011. We were lucky enough to get the golden Nika for this at Ars Electronica, which was certainly a great honor, and we've been showing this work around a lot. It comes in the form of that's one of our posters. It comes in the form of a small wall wart, like a little Netzdecker kind of thing. Plug it into the wall. It attacks the local wireless network, just using, in the first version, just ARPcache spoofing. Attacks the local wireless network, routes all of the traffic through itself, and allows the owner of that box. 8 minutes. Cool, that's fine. Yeah. Great. The owner of that box to go to Madagascar, Kuala Lumpur, Auckland, New Zealand, and manipulate the news read on that wireless network. So you plug it in, walk out, and then jump on a plane, and in the comfort of your two-star hotel, you can then start manipulating the news that's actually read on that network. So you could tell people, for instance, that you could cancel flights at an airport, you know, manipulate the sites there, or you could tell people that, in fact, on BBC, that an asteroid storm is imminently on way to Earth, our solar system, and that now's time to crack open the whiskey. So I'm just going to show you the video now, and I think we'll call it a day and open up for questions. Here we go.
It's not that people think they're being subject to propaganda. If people don't think that, they aren't looking for that, they're much easier to propagandize. And that's the genius of our media system.
It's a real bakery. It really exists.
Media is the nervous system of a democracy. If it's not functioning well, the democracy can't function.
Guys. Okay, question time.
Thank you very, very much. Yes, any questions, please? Yes, please line up in front of the microphones.
Shall I just go ahead?
Okay, we will start with questions from IRC.
So the main question on IRC is really, where can I get one of these devices?
Well, actually, we had a how-to up and running for about 2 years, and that the page is currently broken because we lost some images. But many people have made them; they've been used all over the world. We're currently doing an upgrade for some new boards. But if you go to newstweek.com/how-to, you can see that. Admittedly, it's a bit broken there at the moment. But in about a week or two, we should have a whole new. How to there for people to be able to make their own using some modern hardware, because at the moment it's a couple of years old and we want to push out a new release. All the firmware and stuff we have freely available, of course. Well, all the shell scripts themselves you can read and study. Yeah.
Number two, please.
Hi there. Thanks for bridging the new media community with the hacker community. There isn't enough overlap, in my opinion. But the main question that I have is basically, how do you deal with the fact that a lot of art that also bridges activism to a certain degree anyway, often ends up as a sort of like gesture in a gallery? Like, you showed us a lot of work that is exhibited at Transmediale, etc., and so on, but like, how do you actually bring it into like your practice? How do you see it deployed in the world? Like, how is that not just a gesture?
Oh, absolutely. This is really important. It's important to break away from the black box of the art world itself. You could even argue, you know, for many people it's opaque. Those that that have some contact with the kinds of conversations around art as a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy much of the time, especially as regards the market now. It's just really closed, you know. So the way that we do it is for one thing, we show that it works. We do it in big public museums. Secondly, we build workshops around the projects that are for general public, and we've been very lucky to work with organizations all over the world, cultural organizations that bring general public in. They have zero skill base at the get up and go. But then we take them through to having real contact with some of these ideas through the actual engineering, through the material itself. We do a lot of that. The other thing to do is to upload how-tos so other people can make their own and then freak their friends and family out, you know, And this is definitely what happened with Newstwig. Many people were making these little war plugs. It ended up pissing people off all around the world, actually.
Thanks.
Yep.
Please, a question from number four.
Yeah. Have you ever thought of applying those Newstweets to cars, taxis, things like that, so you only get a distraction for a moment? You know, I have my news site, and I read something, and I click reload, or maybe go back to an article, and it's different. So it's a little bit static, the way you do it with the wall plugs, and I think the distraction would be even greater if things move. So just put a solar cell on it, or maybe mount it on some taxi or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, most people, when they're reading the news in a taxi, they're going through the 3G, 4G network. So it's a totally different... Yep.
I'm not talking about a taxi to distract the guys in a taxi, but in the dense populated areas,
yep.
You could use taxis because they have... you have a lot of beacons around there. So from networks, from the houses...
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I suppose if you could change the network topology fast enough,
okay.
You couldn't use something like ARP cache spoofing. It would be too slow and too unreliable.
Okay.
You'd need to use, but yeah, so that's an interesting idea. Maybe trams would be good because that sort of speed would be enough for you to be able to go around and you know really work with a whole bunch of open wireless networks. Many cities have open access points now. That opens up the territory a lot, and so you're getting out into the street is maybe a more interesting direction. Sure, good. Yep.
We might have time for about three more questions. Number four, please.
I've heard about Newstweek, but I didn't know that you were the guy behind it.
One of two. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any other projects you did recently? And do you have?
I'm really focused on GSM, cell tower infrastructure at the moment, but I can't really talk about that. I also need to talk to my lawyer a bit about, he's one of the good ones, actually, as to what I can and can't do and how I represent it. Dunya and I are working hard on an upcoming intervention in Berlin that we're going to test out in Transmediala and then take it to the next level after that. Lots of stuff really. I'm also interested very much in looking at more rapid prototyping, low tech solutions, a bit like the Nullstecker, you know, projects like this that you can drive the point home with a bang. You know, not necessarily need to go quite so hard all the time. You can follow what we're doing online. I'd love to tell you about the GSM stuff, but I just can't. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on your website, you
keep
it up to date.
Yeah, I'll be pushing some stuff there. Okay. Yep. Sure. Cool, man. Thanks.
One more question from IRC.
So some people are interested in the firmware and the source for the transparency grenade as well, which doesn't seem to be on the website.
Well, the transparency grenade itself is extremely simple. It's on that level. It's just basically it's TCP dump. Capturing with it's running Debian on a Overo COM from Gumsticks, and then TCP dump is running with a snap len of zero, and it's just capturing everything it possibly can, and then it tunnels it over a VPN to my server. So the interesting stuff that I'm working on publishing at the moment is really on the server side. It's all the Perl. That's the stuff that's interesting, that does the TCP stream following and formats it in an interesting and useful way. On the grenade, it's really just a case of a few shell scripts that work meaningfully with a target network. For instance, you might want to supply a key, or if it's just an open network, you don't need to, of course. And then it's just a few GNU utils. Nothing too exciting, but I will publish it all soon, I promise.
Number one, please.
The work you showed was very disruptive and destructive. Would you ever consider a more positive approach of engineering positive examples of technology?
I think lots of people are sort of doing that already. I'm really interested, and Dunya is too, in product inducing productive, healthy paranoia. And fear, fear is a good way to that, you know. Like when you're actually changing stuff on someone's phone, because they don't make a distinction between you know, where that, you know, the network service they're using all the time. But if you can change what happens in that little rectilinear bounds on their phone, which they're inherently dependent upon, that being a consistent relationship with a trusted provider. It could be a news source, or it could even just actually be the your data plan, or it could be, you know, the wireless network you're using, Starbucks. If you can manipulate that space and introduce fear and paranoia into that space, then already you're beginning what I would describe as a healthy, healing, positive process of change. Yeah.
One last question from IRC.
Last question from IRC is, are you worried about legal repercussion, in particular from Newsweek?
Yeah, we had a lot of people writing to us wanting to buy hundreds of these little boxes. We had a very, very bizarre one from a Chechen source. They didn't seem to realize that Danya himself is from St. Petersburg, which is a bit unusual. But at the moment that we are to sell any of these things, we are immediately in a very, very different legal category. And so we prefer to work, you know, as in a research-like sort of territory, applied nonetheless, but we're not in the market of actually pushing this stuff out into the world as a product. That then would, according to my lawyer at least, put us in a very different legal domain. At the moment, we're quite okay. Again, disclaimers are really everything. You know, if you write on a site, this is intended to scare your sister, you know, not people at airports, then yeah, what can a lawyer say?
Thank you very much for your talk.
Pleasure.